Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, September the 4th, 1995. Our speaker this morning is Cedric Broughton, and the speaker is talking on Palestine, Abram through Solomon. Let's listen in on Cedric Broughton.
My name is Cedric Broughton. The title of this session is The History of the Land of Palestine, Abraham to Solomon. That sounds like a broad topic, doesn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Let me begin by just saying how this class came to be. I am principally a pastor. I'm not an academician. I pastor the First Baptist Church of Tacoma, Washington. And about a year and a half ago, a little over a year and a half ago now, I had the good fortune, along with John Peterson, I don't know if you've met him, he's the program director here, to go to Israel. And it really was one of the life-changing events for me in many ways, to actually land, walk in the land that Jesus had walked in, to see the sights that I'd read about in the Bible for years. It was a very significant experience in my life. One of the things that struck me most when I was there is how much I didn't know.
Yeah.
Have any of you been to Palestine, Israel, Holy Land? A few of you. Well, feel free as we go through this to jump in with your own thoughts, your own observations, perspectives, because I certainly don't have a monopoly on those. But one of the things that struck me when I was there is the fact that there's a whole lot of what has gone on in that land in the last 3,500 to 4,000 years that I just didn't know about, or I hadn't really given much thought to. Now, I was a history major in college. I'd been a pastor for a dozen years. I'd studied the Bible most of my life. And yet I came up realizing that there was a whole lot I just didn't know. And so that really got me thinking when I came back from Israel. And so I began to do extra reading and thinking. And I prepared what I'm going to teach this week for my own church. And I'm going to do a kind of an abbreviated version of what I did at my church for you this week in terms of talking about the history of the land of Palestine. One of the things that you all are no doubt aware is that the Middle East is very much in the news. This is a copy of the Jerusalem Post newspaper, and it's about a week old, and week ending August 26th. And it has articles about the peace accord that was in Oslo between Arafat and Rabin. It has articles about, is Saddam Hussein going to attack Israel? It has an article about what's going on in the West Bank. A settler fired his M16 at some Palestinians near Beit El. When I was in Israel, I was at Beit El, which is near which is just north of Jerusalem, and Beit El is in the West Bank area. You've heard of the West Bank. I'll show a map in a few moments that shows that. So there's a lot going on there right now in Israel, and it's in the news quite often, at least in the papers in Tacoma, and I assume wherever you are as well, it's in the news. One of the things that struck me when I was in Israel is how much just seeing the geography of the land affects my understanding of what's going on over there. I don't know if any of you get to National Geographic. This issue is May 1993, issue of National Geographic, and it has a long article on the Middle Eastern water situation. The dividing up of that precious resource among the different countries in the Middle East, and the difficulties that produces between nations and peoples. You can understand, if you've been over there, how precious water is, because so much of that land is desert-like, in certain areas. And so you need that water to survive. It's very precious. So all these things hit me, and I created this class because of that. Now, some people say, well, so what? You know, why study the history of the land of Palestine? As a Christian, I want to know the Bible, and I want to know it better and better as I go along. And to me, actually having been there and seen the places helps me to understand what I read in the Bible better. Those of you who've been there, have you had that experience?
Yeah.
When you read the Bible and you can picture a little bit about where these events happened, it just opens up a whole new understanding of the scriptures to you. Another thing that struck me over there, the so what, why look at this, is when I looked at the geography of the land, I became more and more impressed with Jesus. Do you know the poem One Solitary Life? That was written by a Baptist. Did you know that? That was written by a pastor of the First Baptist Church of Los Angeles back in the 1920s. I know some places when you see it, it says it's an anonymous author, but he wasn't anonymous. That poem really hit me in a way that I had never had it hit me before I went to Israel, because it's an incredibly small country. I'm going to share a few facts about the geography in a minute. But it's an incredibly small area that Jesus walked around and talked in and did his ministry in. It just, you know, isn't very far from one place to another. And so that really struck me when I was there. It became remarkable to me that that this man from what was essentially a backwater place, a little town, backwater area of the world, influences my life today. That's an incredible fact to me. And then, again, to understand what's going on in the Middle East today with water, with the wars, with the Palestinian and Israeli situation, to understand that, it's helpful to know a little bit about what's gone on in that land from the time of Abraham to the time, even before the time of Abraham, to the time of today, to understand the conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis, the Jews. It's helpful to understand the history of what's gone on in that land. And whether we like it or not, even though we're thousands of miles away from Israel, and whether or not we are a Christian, what goes on in the Middle East affects us today. We are a global community, and the Middle East has always been, throughout its history, a hot spot for events in the world and the tug of war between nations. And certainly that's been true in the 20th century, the tug of war between various world powers in this 20th century. And so, any of you familiar with Charles Colson?
Mm-hmm.
One of his books, and I don't remember which book it is, I think it's Kingdoms in Conflict, he has this, he starts off the book by having this story, this scenario about the President of the United States having to deal with this group in Israel who wants to blow, a group of Jews who want to blow up the Dome of the Rock. You know what the Dome of the Rock is?
Yeah.
Okay, and so, and how, it's a fictionalized account, of course, but he talks about how that influences us in the United States, that act that takes place thousands of miles from us. What happens in Israel, what happens in the Middle East does affect us, whether we're Christians or not, because it affects our world today. So that's kind of a bit of an introduction. Now I have on the board the title of a book that I ordered. There were five. There's only four copies of this in the bookstore now. It's called The Land and the Book, An Introduction to the World of the Bible by Charles Page and Carl Volz, V-O-L-Z. And it's a book that I recommend because, not only because I listened to Charles Page lecture when I was in Israel, but because it's kind of unique. The first half of the book goes through a little bit of the geography of the land and then a brief description of the history of the land from the time of Abraham to today. The second half of the book describes sites in Israel that are mentioned in the Bible, a few that aren't mentioned in the Bible, but talks about them from an archaeological standpoint and just gives you a basic understanding of what that site is. For example, this is Hebron. And do you see this? Do you recognize this structure?
Yeah.
What happened to this structure? This building, it's called, I can't ever pronounce it, Machpelah, was where about a year and a half ago, a Jewish doctor went in and killed, shot down a bunch of Muslims at prayer.
I thought you meant
in
antiquity.
And, well, what happened in antiquity there? Do you know what happened?
No.
Why is this site a significant site? This is where Abraham and Sarah are buried. And that's why it's venerated by Jews and by the Islamic people and to a certain extent by Christians. So this tells you, this will tell you a little bit about Hebron and about that. So it's a good, it's a really good reference book. And it would be a good book for a study in your Sunday school. Yes?
The author is?
Charles Page, P-A-G-E.
Israel.
And Carl Vols, V-O-L-Z. And it's published by Abington. And Carl Vols is a Lutheran. So that makes it better. Let me begin by giving us a little perspective on the area where Israel is geographically. Can you see that? Can you make out where Israel is? Okay, there is Israel right there. Okay, here's the Mediterranean Sea. There's Israel. There's what is today Lebanon, Jordan, Saudi Arabia. Over here is Egypt. There's the Nile Delta. Over here is Iraq. See this little city, Ur? Who came from Ur? Okay, and over here, of course, would be where the Persians and up here is Iran, and there's Turkey. That gives you an idea, just generally, a reminder of where Israel is located geographically. It's a tiny country. You look at that and see it is bordered by all these other countries that are much larger in terms of acreage and territory than Israel is. So it is interesting that Israel has had such an impact upon the world, considering its relationship in terms of space to these other countries. Now that's there's the Holy Land. The Holy Land can be divided up geographically several different ways, but let me talk about it in terms of regions. Up here is Galilee, the area of Galilee. You see the Sea of Galilee. One of the things that struck me when I was over there is how small the Sea of Galilee is. We came up Lake Chelan. You know, I don't know how large Lake Chelan is, but it's got to be bigger than the Sea of Galilee. The Sea of Galilee, I don't remember, I don't think I wrote it down exactly how big it is, but it's like 12 miles by 7 miles, something like that. It's pretty tiny. So this is the area, the region of Galilee. Tyre is what is now Lebanon. The Galilean Mountains rise to up here, Mount Hermon, about 3,900 feet. And water drains from this down to the Sea of Galilee. See this? That's Lake Hula, which doesn't exist anymore because the Israelis have seen that as fertile farming land and filled it in so that it doesn't, so that they could have that for farming land. So there is no little lake, but at the time of Jesus, there was a little lake there. The Golan Heights are right here, which are about 2,500 feet in elevation to 3,000 feet. When you are there, this right over here is the city of Tiberias, where it's the large city where all the tourists stay. And when you're there, and I was staying in a hotel where I could look out over the Sea of Galilee, you see how close the Golan Heights are. And when you see how close the Golan Heights are, you understand a little bit of the Israelis' fear of giving them up. Because it's nothing to lob a modern shell from there over to the other side where Tiberias is, where a large population center is. So we have in Galilee kind of a mountainous, it's not as big of the mountains as we have here in the west, but it's a mountainous area. Good rainfall, lots of rich agriculture. Hazor, let's see, that's not on this map, but Hazor is up here someplace. Hazor was one of the largest cities in the ancient Near East, and it dated back at least to the 15th century BC. This is the plain of Esdraelon. This is the Jezreel Valley right there. Let's see if that one, no, that one doesn't. Oh, it doesn't have a... Right around here, the Jezreel Valley is a rich farming area in Israel today. But one of the things that makes it important is when you went from Egypt, you went up along the coast here, and you went through this valley and then on up to Damascus. That was the trade route. And this valley... is an area where they could go through it without going through a lot of mountains. Now, do you know what city is located in that valley? It makes it so famous?
Megiddo.
Megiddo, right? Do you know what Megiddo, where is it? You know that name Megiddo? Do you know the name Armageddon?
Yeah.
Armageddon is simply the mountain of Megiddo. Okay, and that sits on one end of this Jezreel Valley. And at the other end is Mount Tabor, which is one site that they believe might have been where the transfiguration took place. So this valley is where, you know, if you read some of the popular books on the second coming of Christ, Hal Lindsey and that sort of thing, talk about Armageddon, it's talking about that area, that valley there. Is very fertile, and it is an area where Israel gets a lot of their produce. By the way, Israel today exports to Europe its fruits and vegetables. That's one of the ways they make money, is exporting fruits and vegetables to Europe, as well as through tourism they get money. This area right here, this mountainous area below the Jezreel Valley, is ancient Samaria, and it is, if I map, get this on the map correctly, can you see there?
Yeah.
This is the West Bank, okay? So this area, which is mountainous, ancient Samaria, that's the West Bank. And that is the central mountain area. Right along here, of course, the Jordan River, there's a valley here, and that's also an agricultural area until you get down to Jericho. It only takes, to go from Tiberias down to Jericho, I think it was about an hour and a half bus ride. Does that sound right to you, those of you who've been there? About an hour from up here to Jericho. So it is not a long distance between the two sites. Down here is Jerusalem, and there's Jericho. Do you know how many miles it is between Jerusalem and Jericho? Anybody know? It's about 16 or 17 miles, that's all. But it goes from, if you're walking, it'd be a long way. It goes from how many feet below sea level? Let's see. Where did I? Oh, I don't see it in my notes. But it's the Jericho is below sea level, like 800 feet or something like that. And Jerusalem is 2,500 feet above sea level. So you can see that it's quite a climb in that 16, 17 miles. And you're going from what is essentially a desert. Jericho is an oasis, but all around it is, you have a kind of a desert-like area, particularly around here in the Dead Sea. You're going up the mountains to Jerusalem. So when you talk about going up to Jerusalem, you're talking about literally going uphill to Jerusalem as well. This is the coastal area, which also is a farming area. And right behind the coastal area, there's what they call the Shephelah, small hills, mountains, that are not as high in height as those further inland. It kind of reminds me, you know, on the west coast here, we have the coastal mountains, and then you have the Cascade Range, or in California, Sierra. So it's two different levels of mountains. But along the coast, it's a fertile area, it is an agricultural area, and then you have the Shephelah, and then you come to this more mountainous area. And this is the Negev, this is desert. Beersheba means seven springs, and Hebron is down in this same type of area. Any questions? You have any questions? Those of you who've been to Israel, any comments about the geography of the land? The area. It's important to know what the land is like because it affects how people interact in that land. It is also important to know the land to understand some of the mentality of the people over there. This area here that's in green. Was where in 1948 the Jewish people were originally given in the initial idea of partitioning the land into between Palestinian state and the Jewish state, an idea that never really, you know, didn't pan out. But that was the initial idea, and you'll notice that Jerusalem, Bethlehem, Hebron, all these important sites that are important to the Jewish people are not in that portion that was originally designed to give to them. But they accepted that because they were accepting a compromise. You know that this is called Transjordan. This is where Jordan is now. Jordan, after 1948, controlled all this area, okay, that you see here. And up here, Syria had the Golan Heights area. Let me just give you a contemporary story.
Who has the Golan Heights now?
Israel has the Golan Heights now.
What was the rationale of that kind of a partition?
Well, it...
It seemed like there's not a lot of fertile area in there. Because the Jordan River area in the West Bank was where you...
Well, the rationale, and I'm going to talk about this on Saturday some, but the rationale has to do with politics. It had to do with the British, you know, the British mandate in the early part of this century, who was supporting whom. It was all politics. It, you know, logic really wasn't part of it. It was who's in control and who am I going to favor so that my political diplomatic situation works out the best for me. It's kind of how it is. One of the experiences I had when I was there was to go to one of the West Bank settlements near, well, it was called Beit El, Bethel. You know what that means, by the way, in Hebrew? Anybody? El is God, and Beth, or Beit, is house. So Bethel is house of God. Bethlehem, Lehem, is bread. So it's house of bread. One of the experiences I had going there was to be able to listen to this woman from the Jewish settlement there. We met in a little synagogue, a busload of us. John Peterson, who's hiding up there, was part of that group, and we got to get her perspective on the world. And her perspective on the world was shown by a map that she put up, similar to this map, except her map was color-coded. And one color, she had shaded in all the countries around Israel that are Islamic, Arab. So that includes all here, all through here, all through here, up through here. A whole lot of territory. And then she had in another color shaded in Israel, which was a little tiny portion of the map. And her argument, which is the argument of those who are settling on the West Bank, is why can't the Palestinians go someplace else? They got all this area that they should be able to go because these are all Islamic peoples. And we only have this itty-bitty little area, and we should have it for our own. That was her argument, her rationale for saying the Palestinians shouldn't be in this West Bank territory, I should be here. Interestingly enough, she was actually a Jew from New York City who immigrated to Israel and was raising, she was a grandmother by the time I saw her, but raising her children and grandchildren there. So that gives you a little idea of how geography and how what's going on around affects the mentality of the people. Any other comments or questions?
Can you point out where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found on that map?
Sure, the Dead Sea Scrolls are found right about here. Qumran is right below Jericho.
I have an interesting detail.
Okay.
I was talking to a Jewish couple who are on a kibbutz there, and they measure the water on each plant by drops. And if they take too much water out, then the seawater comes in and pollutes the whole bit. So it's a very scientific thing.
Yes, they are... they've developed water conservation to a fine science over there in Israel. And this issue of National Geographic talks about some of that. It has some interesting pictures about how they grow plants over there. They have, their vegetables are grown under plastic and irrigated with, as you say, drops of water. They measure it out very scientifically. So it's quite incredible. And of course, breakfast over there is full of fruits and vegetables, which are very good. Somebody said Qumran is a little bit further south.
I thought it was.
Yeah, it's hard to be precise, but it's somewhere in this area.
South of Jerusalem.
Well, it's south of Jericho. It's right on the Dead Sea.
Yeah.
Right there. And Masada is a little bit further down. You've heard of Masada?
Yeah, right.
And then down here, we went to a place where we could float in the Dead Sea. It's a resort area that the Israelis have built up, and you can float in the Dead Sea if you choose to do that or get a mud pack on.
We came into Tel Aviv now. That's not given on the map.
Tel Aviv is right here where Joppa is. Okay. That's Tel Aviv. And this is... to the city of Gaza. There's the Gaza Strip, okay, right down there. As we begin to look at the persons in the biblical record of the land, what's happened in the land of Palestine, we naturally start with one person. Who is that?
Abraham.
And if you have a Bible, you could turn to Genesis 12. Abraham is a significant figure in history because he's revered by three of the great religions of the world, which are
Christianity,
Jews, and Islam, right? All three of these religions claim Abraham as their father, as their ancestor. And so Abraham is an important figure in history. There's no doubt about it, because all of these three great religions of the world date back their existence, their theology, who they are as a people, to Abraham. And so it's important to know the Abraham story if you're going to know a little bit about the land of Palestine. Abraham went from where?
Ur.
And he went up to what is in now what country? Syria. Okay. And then he went down. Let's look at... let's read verses 1 to 9 of Genesis 12. Do I have a volunteer to read the first 9 verses of Genesis 12?
Go forth from your country and your kindred and your father's house into a land that I will show thee, and I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you, I will bless those who bless you, and I will those that curse you, I will curse.
Okay, that's the first 3 verses. Good. You know more by memory than I do. Now, what about the rest? Okay, somebody want to pick up with verse 4?
Abraham, who was 75 years old when he left Haran, set out as the Lord had bidden him, and Lot went with him. He took his wife Sarah, his brother's son Lot, and all the possessions they had gathered, and the dependents they had acquired in Haran, and they departed for Canaan. When they arrived there, Abram went on as far as the sanctuary at Shechem, the terebinth tree of Moreh. At that time, the Canaanites lived in the land. Did you say 6?
Verse 9.
When the Lord appeared to him and said, I am giving this land to your descendants, Abraham built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. From there he moved on to the hill country east of Bethel and pitched his tent between Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. He built there an altar to the Lord whom he invoked by name. Thus Abraham journeyed by stages toward the Negev.
Okay. So the promise to Abraham was what? Abram at this time.
Make a great nation.
Make a great nation, descendants,
land,
right? The land and the book is the title of it. So for the Israelis, for the Jews, this promise to Abraham of land is a sacred, holy promise to them. This is our land. What's interesting in Israel is that even those who are Jewish, who have no, who are not religious Jews, who are totally secular Jews, atheist Jews even, will claim this promise. You know, it's not tied to a religious feeling for them, but it is still their promise to them as a people, is how they see it. Very, very interesting. Okay, look at chapter...
Why would if Abraham's the three religions, Islam, then why would that place be Jewish as opposed to No,
Lot was the promise to all three.
All three.
Well, let's look at a couple more verses and think about that. Look at chapter 15, verse 4. Chapter 15, verse 4. The word of the Lord came to Abraham, "This man shall not be your heir. No one but your very own issue shall be your heir." Okay? So that was when he was going to have another heir, the Eleazar of Damascus. Okay, then look at chapter 16, verses 1 to 15. Just glance at that. That concerns the birth of the firstborn son of Abraham, was Ishmael. Okay? Ishmael was born to Hagar, who the Bible says was the servant of Sarah, but where was she from?
Egypt.
Okay? And there is, look at verse 11 of chapter 16. "You've conceived and shall bear a son. You shall call him Ishmael, for the Lord has given heed to your affliction. He shall be a wild ass of a man, with his hand against everyone and everyone's hand against him. He shall live at odds with all his kin." So she named the Lord who spoke to her, "You are El Roy," for she said, "Have I really seen in God and remained alive after seeing him?" Hagar bore Abram a son. Abram named his son whom Hagar bore him Ishmael. Okay, then look at chapter 21. Chapter 21, beginning in verse 8. Hagar and Ishmael are sent away after Sarah finally bears her son, whose name is
Isaac.
Okay, so they're sent away. They're cast out, away from the territory. God said in verse 12 of chapter 21, God said, "Do not be distressed because of the boy and because of your slave woman. Whatever Sarah says to you, do as she tells you, for it is through Isaac that offspring shall be named for you. As for the son of the slave woman, I will make a nation of him also, because he is your offspring." And so Abraham sent her away. Then verse 20, God was with the boy, and he grew up, and he lived in the wilderness, became an expert with the bow. He lived in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother got a wife for him from the land of Egypt. Then chapter 25, verses 7 to 18, concerns the death of Abraham. Abraham died. He had more children after Isaac and after Ishmael. He had more children. He died. He was buried in that cave that I showed you the picture of. Who buried him? Look at the text in chapter 20.
His sons.
His sons. Which sons?
Isaac and Ishmael.
Both of them buried him. Both Isaac and Ishmael buried Abraham. And then they went their separate ways. And verse 12 and following, the descendants of Ishmael are listed. Yes?
Do you know if the story for the Islamic people is the same in their, is it the Quran? Is that particular story the same as it is?
I haven't read the Quran, so I really can't answer that. I know that their tradition goes back to Abraham. And really, in point of fact, Muhammad didn't claim to be creating something new. He accepted even Jesus as a prophet. And so what the Hebrew Bible has, I haven't read the Quran, so I don't know if it speaks to this or not, but what the Hebrew Bible has written down, in my understanding, is part of what the Islamic peoples would say is part of their history as well.
Because it's interesting, it definitely says that Ishmael will be blessed, won't he?
Yeah.
I just wonder if their book says it differently.
Yeah, I really can't answer that, but that's a good question to look into. But it's interesting in light of the conflict between Palestinians and the Israelis today, here you have both of them came together and buried their father Abraham. Oh, that there would be that kind of peace between the peoples today, we would say. So the story of the history of the land of Palestine starts with Abraham, starts with, at least according to the biblical record, starts with this wandering nomad, this person who biblical record says was called forth from Ur, from Haran, came down and settled in Hebron, down in this area. He sojourned for a while up here in the mountains that we call Samaria, but which is where Shechem is. But then he came down to and Abraham, Isaac, Jacob are all from the southern area. Jacob was given by God another name, which was
Israel.
Okay, so that's how that name comes about. Jacob had a son. He had a lot of sons. One of his sons went down to Egypt. His name was
Joseph.
And when he was in Egypt, the rest of the family came on down because there was
famine
in the land. You all know the Bible well. I'm impressed. So there was famine in the land, so they came down and they lived there for a while.
400 years,
yes. Now, I'm not going to get into this a whole lot, but I'm going to throw something at you to think about, because it's interesting to study archaeology in connection with the Bible and to try to put all these things together in your mind. One of the things when you look at what archaeologists have to say is that the way that we date things, if we take the dating in the Bible on the face value, it doesn't always necessarily match up with the way that the archaeologists date things. Now, why that is, you know, there are lots of different explanations, and you can believe what you want to believe. My personal opinion is that a lot of the numbers in the Bible are more symbolic than they are real. You know, 40 years is repeated over and over and over again, not meaning a literal 40 years, but this is a generation, a period of time. And so they don't all date things, you know, if you take the dating of the Bible and you take the dating of archaeology, it doesn't always necessarily mesh with one another. If you're interested in that topic, and you may not be, but if you are, there's a book called Ancient Israel, which is actually a compilation of articles by a number of different archaeologists going from the time of Abraham to 70 AD. And the editor is Herschel Shanks. You know that name? He is the one who founded the Biblical, the BAR, Biblical Archaeology Review magazine and society. And so he's the editor of this particular book. But it has some interesting chapters in it about the patriarchs and how it's dated archaeologically and that sort of thing. So that might be one you want to take a look at some point. There is a lot of different opinion as to who came where, when, and what. And you can, again, you can believe what you want to believe. I'm not going to talk about Moses very much, but Moses came up with the people of Israel, right, to the promised land. And when they got to the promised land, here's Mount Nebo, which is the place where what happened? No. That's Mount Sinai. That's way down here.
Yeah.
That's where Moses died, right?
Yeah.
That's where Moses died, looking over onto the, into the promised land. And then who took over for Moses?
Joshua.
And they crossed Jordan River and went to Jericho. Okay? Jericho is one of the most interesting sites to me in Israel. If you go to the archaeological dig, you see this kind of roundish structure that dates back about 9,000 years, according to the archaeologist. The oldest
wall that came tumbling down?
Yes.
Yes.
That's not the wall that came tumbling down. That particular wall, I mean, there's several number of different layers of the dig, but that particular wall dates back to about 7,000 BC, and they say that is how do they put it? It's the oldest continuous inhabited city that they can come up with in the world. Right here around Jericho, this area of the Dead Sea is the lowest dry land in the world. The elevation is the lowest in the world of dry land. So Israel came in as a people, according to the biblical record, came in from Egypt and entered into the land. And when they got there, what did they discover? There's already people there, right?
Yeah, giants.
There's already people there. This is, you know, as you think about the situation today, we have to ask some questions. And one of them is, did the Jewish people go into a chosen land that was empty?
Oh, no.
No, there were people there, right? There were already folks living there. Now, there's lots of debates about how many folks there were living there. And there are lots of debates about how the people of Israel, how the people who came to be called Israel, came into the land. And if you read this particular book, you'll get a variety of opinions on that. Because some would argue that it was only a small remnant that came up from Egypt, that in fact some of the people who were already in the land took on the religion of those who believe in Yahweh. Do you know the term Yahweh? Mm-hmm. Term for God? There's different opinions about how many people actually came in the land. And there are different opinions about how the land was conquered, or if it was in fact conquered by the Jewish people as they came in. Archaeological evidence for some of the things that are described in the book of Joshua is pretty scant. And so there are, absent of that kind of knowledge, some of the opinions of some scholars and archaeologists is that some of the way that it's described in Joshua is not exactly what happened. I mean, the city of Ai didn't really get destroyed because it wasn't there when Joshua entered the land, is what some archaeologists would argue. Whether or not that's, you choose to believe that or not, it is important to realize that as the Jewish people came into this land, as the people who came to follow the God Yahweh were in this land and began to settle in and to build a existence in that land, that the people who were already there were still there. Okay, the Jewish people, Joshua and the tribes of Israel, never wiped out everybody that was in the land and took it over so that there were only Jews in the land at that time. Do you understand the implications of that? Yes?
The book of Judges explains a lot of that.
Sure does.
Because there were times when the Philistines came against them, and that's why we have the book of Judges telling about how they had war there.
Sure. And that's these arrows. See on this map, these arrows describe some of the ones that the scribes and judges they had war. Amalekites, the Moabites, the Midianites, the Ammonites, King Jabin from Hazor, Mesopotamians. There's the Philistines. There were wars with those outlying city-states, kingdoms outside of Israel proper, we might say today. But there were also people within it.
The Canaanites were in the land, weren't they?
The Canaanites were in there, and they were not wiped out. The point I'm making is they weren't wiped out. There were still Canaanites in the land when the people who came to follow the God Yahweh were in the land. Put in terms of today, we might say there have always been both Jews and Palestinians in the land. And that should have implications for how we view the situation over there today in the Middle East.
That supports the Palestinians' argument that they were there first.
Well, yeah, it depends on, and again, it depends upon how you trace the ancestry of the modern-day Palestinians, and that becomes a point of discussion at some point.
You know, that mixed up with the, intermarried with them and mixed up with the peoples that were there. And then they started worshiping the other gods and had problems that way.
That's right. How would you sum up the book of Judges? What's the book? How's the book of Judges summed up? Does anybody know?
Conquering chose to have a king instead of an idolatry.
Well, there isn't a king yet. The Israelis don't have a king yet. The Jews don't have a king yet. Okay, but that comes later. That comes later. First of all, what do we have described in the book of Judges? We have a description of the people who came in. They loved the Lord, Yahweh. Then what did they do?
They were influenced by the others.
They worshiped some of the other gods of the peoples of that land, of the Canaanites. They sinned. Then what happened? See, these invasions are what? They are the punishment, according to the Judges, for the sin of the people of Israel. Then what do the people of Israel do?
Repent.
They cry out, say, God, we blew it. We want help. And so God sends a judge. A judge that's the story of the book of Judges. It's actually the story of the Bible, but it's encapsulated in the book of Judges. So you have that story, and the enemy peoples are all around him. And Judges chapter 2 sums up the entire book. So if you want to read Judges chapter 2 sometime, you can see how the book is summed up. So what do we have? We have in this land Canaan, that used to be called Canaan. We call Palestine. Palestine, by the way, is the name that the Romans gave to it. Israel. We have this people who, some of whom migrated up from Egypt, some of whom may have already been in the land, but these people who take Yahweh as their God. Okay? And they are all living there now together. There are a number of tribes, according to the biblical record. And can you see that? It's kind of faint. That lists the territory of the tribes. There's the Jordan Valley. Okay? Notice that Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh, half of Manasseh, are in what is today Jordan. Okay? So that is, and Dan moves up from here, goes up there. Started out down here, moved up there. We have these tribes that follow Yahweh, and they're in the land. And then along comes Saul, and we won't talk about Saul very much because of time. But after Saul comes David, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Under David, what happens in this territory? It becomes David. Saul's the first king, but David is the real king. Saul was a little more than a warrior king who basically fought battles his whole life long, and was finally killed and hung on the walls of, you know what city? Beth Shean, one of the cities of the Decapolis. So David manages through his ability as a warrior, his ability as a statesman to a certain extent, and according to the biblical record, because he was the man after God's own heart, right? You know that phrase? David, who was very faithful to Yahweh, according to the biblical record, expanded the territory and the control. Now, one of the things that we can notice is that, from historical records, is that Egypt and the Assyrians over here, Egypt down here, the countries that have given Israel a bad time through the centuries were weak at this point in time. So there was a century when the Egyptians and the Assyrians and the others weren't quite as strong, and that's the century that David and Solomon reigned as kings. And so there is the confluence of events in history that helped to bring this about. One of the important things that that David did in his reign as king was to make a particular place the center of their worship, the center of who they are as a people, and that place is
Jerusalem.
Now, Jerusalem, you know what Jerusalem means in Hebrew? It means city of peace, shalom, okay? But what's interesting, and I just learned this this year, is that there is, Jerusalem had other people living in it before David came along, of course. There were Canaanites living there. And they had a god whose name was Shalim, S-H-A-L-I-M, the god of the setting sun. And when the Hebrews came in, they had this word Shalom, S-H-A-L-O-M, their word for peace. So Jerusalem became, instead of Jerusalem, the god of the setting sun, Jerusalem, the god of the city of peace. So that's kind of interesting. David brought the ark to Jerusalem. He set up a sense that this was the capital, not only the capital, but the place that is the worship center for the people. And his son Solomon did what?
Built
a temple at that spot. That site where he built the temple is today what?
Dome of the Rock.
The Dome of the Rock, which is a holy place to the Muslim people. So that is the same site as where the Solomon's temple and then after it's Herod's temple sat. You can see why that is an important spot in our world. One final comment for today. One of the things that struck me when I was there was a tie to the land that I don't have personally as a person. I've lived all over the United States in my life, and I don't have a particular tie to a spot on earth. But the people there, the Palestinians, the Jewish people, that's the place where those stones have seen their blood shed for 3,000 years and more. And it is very sacred.